Hi, everybody. I was just having a discussion with my husband and I thought, you know what, I'm going to stop it there and I'm going to actually share some of this with you. And I really hope I don't forget some of the points we were discussing because I think they're important to share. It's to do with being a late diagnosed autistic person or neurodivergent person, because actually, you know, it applies to ADHD and all the other kind of comorbid conditions and the experiences that so many of us have had. And linking with the medical gaslighting one, also, you know, those who've had chronic illnesses, not been believed, or have, you know, are in pain all the time and struggle with everyday life, and people don't take them very seriously. Excuse me. I'm actually recording this live onto the podcast, meaning I can't edit it. And you've probably noticed that that's what's happened with the last few. They're a bit more raw, and I'm trying to do more of these off the cuff kind of reflections and discussions, because I think sometimes you have thoughts in the moment, and if I write everything down and then plan to share it with you at another stage, it kind of doesn't happen. So yes, they're not quite as professional and planned, but I'm hoping that you still find them of value. So essentially, what we were discussing was my experiences, and it was kind of based on the medical gaslighting podcast and the emotions that that raised for me. And I said to my husband, there are so many things that I've missed in that. And I think, you know, I get frustrated because some of the things I share, they're quite waffly and I kind of go off on a tangent and come back to the point. And I think they're sometimes really hard to follow, but that is sadly how my mind works. Which brings me to the point that I prefer corresponding through email and text rather than phone calls and talking, especially if it's spontaneous, because again, people say to me, but you're articulate, or, you know, in the past I've been told you have like a phone voice or you're good at talking. Why on earth do you choose to email people instead? Like, why would you not pick up the phone and just make a phone call? But what they don't understand is that to make a phone call, I have to plan everything so meticulously to be able to successfully make that call. And even then, if somebody says something to me that I haven't planned and they go off of my script, then I really struggle. And people don't see that with me because they just see this kind of really chatty 38-year-old, you know, and I don't want to paint myself as really incapable because I'm not. In my teaching career, I was responsible for a lot of training and I was really good at that job. But I think there is a real difference somehow between my professional life and my personal life. And I think I've said this before, but when I have teacher hat on, or when I used to have my teacher hat on, or even now, if I'm talking to somebody about autism or something that I feel really confident speaking about, or something that I feel I've got value to add, then, you know, I tend to be a lot better and come across a lot more confident. And I can hear my children downstairs. They're on a game. But my youngest, he gets really dysregulated and he gets really anxious. So at the moment, I can hear that going on. But I'm not going to intervene because daddy's on it. So I'm going to continue speaking. But if things do escalate, I will need to go. This is the reality. And I try so hard to do these things when the children are in bed. But sometimes in the moment, you just have to kind of get in there while it's in there. Anyway, I'm quite confident in some areas. And so I'm not saying that I can't speak or I'm not intelligent. It's not that. And I think this is where people who are not like me, who don't process like me, don't understand. And even though I try and explain exactly what I'm telling you, they just don't understand it. They just see, well, you're fine at speaking. So how on earth could you have a problem? You're not a non-speaking autistic. I'm like, no, I'm very much not that. And then people will laugh and say, no, no, you're not. All you do is talk. But what they don't understand is, a lot of my over-talking comes from my need to sometimes share, my need to be understood. And if you track a lot of this back, it actually goes back to not being understood my whole life, having to always explain what I was thinking and feeling, and just feeling so different and out of it compared, you know, to my peers, really. I mean, I'm probably not explaining that brilliantly well either, but, oh, you know, it's been a tough existence. And I said to my husband, I don't ever want to paint autism as this really, really awful thing, but I can see the trauma that being autistic has caused me. But it's not, oh, you're autistic, you know, therefore autism causes trauma. It's being autistic, as we always say, in a world that just doesn't understand you. And so, you know, for example, when I worked as a teacher, I used to always send emails. And some of this is repeated material, but I'm just trying to use it as an example. I would send emails to the head teacher, for example, or to other colleagues. And I remember getting called into the head teacher's office saying, why on earth do you not just knock on the door and come and speak? First of all, admittedly, she used to get a bit angry. If she was in the zone and somebody interrupted her, she wouldn't be the most approachable person. An amazing professional, but this is the truth. And I'm a pattern detector and I noticed this. So there was no way I was putting myself in that position, especially when I'm already anxious and I'm already heightened. And I already know that I will have trouble getting out my thoughts and being able to process what was being said to me in the moment. So for me, the safest thing is to construct an email or a letter. And even though that can still be misconstrued, it's the best chance I've got of being understood. And I tried to explain this, but again, we didn't know I was autistic at the time. And I think this is where I'm so frustrated. I still think it's really hard for anybody, even if you're diagnosed early, you are still going to have so many challenges and having to navigate this world that isn't made for you. But not knowing you are is really frustrating because you struggle with these things that people find strange and you don't know why. And I can't explain it then adequately to people. Whereas if I could go back in time and know who I was, I can say, right, I'm autistic. These are the challenges I have. And this is, you know, what I need to do in order to be able to thrive. I need to be able to send emails and I need to not feel pressured to have to go and engage in these conversations with you where I'm going to fail and then ultimately be teased, which is what the outcome was. I then had other incidents where we would send letters to parents just to tell them what was going on in the, you know, the term. And I would be very formal, you know, dear parents, this is what we're doing, and just give them the facts. And I remember being teased again, very lightheartedly. It wasn't meant with malice, but colleagues, you know, teasing me for how formal I was in my letters to parents. And I remember one colleague saying, you need to inject some personality in, and kind of gave me some examples and showed me their letters. And then I used that as a model. But I still remember having that feeling of, well, what's wrong with the way I've done it? You know, it's to the point. It's clearly communicating what we're actually doing. I did start to adopt a kind of more informal and personable style. And I will admit, I think that worked with parents. So I understand the value in that. But I think the bit that gets me is being teased all the time for all the things you're doing that are right for you that everybody else finds wrong. And that has basically been my entire life experience. And I think that's something you can't explain to people. And I said to my husband, being late diagnosed has caused a lot of trauma. Now, it's caused so much relief and it's helped me in a lot of ways because it's helped me realise who I am and be able to advocate for myself and my children. And, you know, there's things that I can see about it that I'm like, you know, these are also the positives. And I owe a lot of the things that I can do, like my memory and, you know, I think it's awful to say, but like I think a level of my intelligence and my ability in some areas and my hyper-focus particularly, my ability to learn something I'm interested in to the exclusion of all else, I think can be a blessing and a curse. But generally speaking, there are so many things about being autistic that I love and I wouldn't want to change. But the social elements are the things where I've struggled the most. And I obviously don't believe in functioning labels, but I still get referred to as a high functioning autistic. And people seem to think that when you're a high functioning autistic, you have zero challenges and zero difficulties and you need zero support. And it just couldn't be further from the truth. And I've seen so many comments on my page that people who can record podcasts or run a blog, you are absolutely privileged and you have no challenges and no needs. And it's just not the case. Obviously, I have different needs and different challenges to other individuals. And I will not compare myself to other individuals because we're all different. And yes, there will be some people who don't have the, as people refer to it, the level of function that I do. And I am very grateful that I am able to lead an independent life. And I know there are other autistics who can't. I also know other autistics who are not independent in terms of they have to live with parents, but they have also written on my blog that they actually have a really good life. And although they live still at home or in some supported facility, they still feel that they have a lot of positives and they feel they have less challenges than some other individuals. For example, some of these individuals I've spoken to don't have the same level of mental health issues, and that is because they've been recognised as having needs and those needs have been accommodated. So I think nothing is ever cut and dry, and I don't think we can say something is harder for one and not another without actually having walked in their shoes. And I hope that that's made sense, because again, I'm trying to do it off the cuff and it isn't always clear, but I really hope you understand why. And it is literally because this is how my brain works. And this is why really I have to plan everything extensively if I want to make coherent points. But sometimes that's just not possible. This then leads me on to another experience. And it was when I was at university. I did not know I was autistic until I was actually teaching. So all these years before, I had all these difficulties in life, socially, through school, through college, university. I won't go into detail of all the specifics, but just believe me, there were so many failed interactions, and you can't help but internalise that there is something wrong with you. You can't help but watch everybody else around you kind of succeeding. And I used to see them all doing it with such effortlessness. And there was me trying so hard and still getting it wrong. And even if we went to the cafeteria together, the canteen, I always felt exposed. And I remember saying this to my mum when I was younger. If we were going out or something, like, the getting ready routine for me was horrendous. And it still is. I just don't go anywhere now, so it's not as bad. But when I was young, I had body dysmorphia and a lot of image issues. But getting ready would cause full-on meltdowns. I mean, up until my 20s, but more so in my teens, my late teens. And people were so perplexed by this seemingly intelligent young woman all of a sudden melting down, screaming, crying her makeup off, pulling her hair, throwing clothes around. Me in this moment was a very different individual to what you would normally see when I'm in the workplace, for example, or when I'm masking. And there are times where you just can't mask anymore. And I think that that's maybe the part of autism people don't understand. I've told you before, I got called mental and all kinds of things because of my behaviour as a teenager when I would have these meltdowns, and we didn't know what they were. So my mum was saying to me the other day about this. She said, you know, it was so perplexing and so strange to see you, you know, be who we recognise as you one moment, and then you were like a different person. And she said, you know, I had enough feeling and understanding to know that you were going through something, but I didn't understand, obviously, you were autistic and what had led to it. And, you know, she was amazing at helping me and supporting me, but there were things she didn't understand. And she always says to me, I'm so sorry I didn't know, but there was no way she could have known. It just wasn't on anyone's radar at the time. But I think definitely knowing I was autistic would have been so helpful, because people would have understood me. I'm not saying that, you know, everyone always necessarily understands you, but I know in my context with my mum, for example, I know that it would have helped her to maybe as well explain to other people on my behalf and to advocate for me when I couldn't for myself. And she did a great job of that anyway, without even knowing that I was autistic and without having a label applied, because she just knew that I was different. But my word, I do look back and I do feel grief over the fact that so many things went wrong. And it absolutely was because of the way I communicate and the way I perceive things and the way people perceived me. And I imagine so many of you can relate to that. And really, I should give you so many examples, but I'm feeling overwhelmed with actually how many there are. But I am going to give you one example from university. So I really did struggle with every element there, socially and sensory, especially in my third year. Actually, no, it was my entire university experience, so I'm not going to lie. But I had to have an operation because basically I worked for a bank and developed some health issues and had to have an operation. It was like an RSI type injury, but it was something different, and had to have an operation on my right arm because basically the muscle used to inflame to the point that it felt like it was trying to burst out of my arm. And they did some tests and they said actually that's what was happening after a minute of movement. So they had me pumping a ball, but you know, normally it'd be writing or typing, and after you know, so much of movement, they actually measured the pressure in my arm and the muscles were indeed inflaming, and they said that's normal, but normally the muscle would then reduce, but mine was inflaming and staying inflamed. So therefore, the next time I did any movement, it would inflame again and inflame again. And they said, you know, essentially that feeling you're having of it trying to burst through your arm is a really good explanation, because that's kind of what's happening. So I had to have muscle decompression, where they removed part of my muscle. And I needed it in both arms, but we could only afford to have it done in one. So the other arm, you know, I can handle, because I don't write with that arm. But, you know, I have developed issues in that space. Years on, I've now realised, obviously, I'm hypermobile and have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and it's probably related to that. But we didn't know about that at the time. I'm not going to bore you with those details, but, you know, these are the kinds of things we've been through. So had this surgery, took a year out of university in order to have this done and to recover. And my first 2 years, I struggled with everything. I struggled with typing, and I struggled with even going in. I struggled with the environment. And, you know, as fellow autistics and neurodivergents, or people who know neurodivergence, you probably will be familiar with the fact that settings like schools, universities, they're difficult places to be in. And I very rarely attended. And I've shared before that I actually had some students at one point when I was at college going to lecturers and saying that they felt I didn't deserve to be there because I so rarely went in. And I would just kind of teach myself from home and then go in and take exams. And I get that to the others, they felt that was me making a lack of effort, but I just couldn't go in. And I couldn't understand why myself. There were some days I just could not physically get myself out of the house to go in. And what was sad about some of the other students really being quite unpleasant to me about that was nobody understood why. I didn't even understand why. Again, it would have been really helpful to have known I was autistic and to be able to communicate that, you know, and actually, not just autistic, I identify as a PDA-er. That has been written in my diagnostic report, but I kind of swing backwards and forwards between, am I just having like your typical demand avoidance, which is typical in autism, like to some degree for every individual, or is this actually pathological? The more I read, I do still believe I meet the criteria of PDA, because I can see I've internalized a lot of demands, and I've found ways to control it in a different way. So there was something I read online where I've forgotten who said it, but it was probably Harry Thompson, and I think they said about, you know, if somebody asks for a sweet, you don't just give them one, you give them two, because you are fulfilling the demand, but you're taking control of how you fulfill it. And that basically sums up how I think I coped growing up and as a child, and also I think it relates to perfectionism. And that is another podcast I want to cover that I keep meaning to, but that one needs a bit more research because I want some more examples, but going off on a tangent again. But I think it links with perfectionism. And I wonder sometimes, is it that I'm a perfectionist innately? Is it because I'm autistic and I just have this kind of desire to be perfect, everything to be thorough? And I think that is an element of it. I think that, you know, the way our minds work is you are overwhelmed by the possibilities. And you want to make sure every single thing has been covered adequately. And obviously, when you're in a setting like university or you're having a conversation just in everyday life, people don't require that level of detail and overanalysis, I suppose. But that's the way that my mind works. And I know that so many of you I've spoken to, you know, have the same kind of process. So I think there is an innate perfectionism in us. But I think we also become perfectionists because it's our way of controlling how people see us and controlling how we cope in certain situations. And at school, I had so many failures with social interactions that I think the thing I could control was, you know, how I performed academically. And I think the same happened when I was at college and university. Things broke down for me, even if they started well. It always started where I'd have these nice friendships or people would accept me, but it didn't ever last the more they got to know me. And sometimes that would be down to the fact that I'd go into shutdowns, or one day I'd be very chatty and the next day I couldn't function or talk. And people then find you very standoffish and unpredictable and difficult to be around. And I remember being told several times I was negative. And I can see now how that was the perception, but actually I wasn't being negative, but I'm a realist. And I used to making commentaries about life and politics and pointing out things that were correct and factual. And that's not how other people like to converse. You know, they like the small talk. And I don't know, I think people mask in general, surely, because surely that's not all that's really going on in their brains, and unless it is. But I just can't imagine it. And I just can't engage in those kind of what I deem as quite boring conversations. And again, that sounds like I'm being really judgmental, but I just think it's crazy that, you know, my whole life there's, I would rather speak about something factual and important, but then people say, well, that's important to you, but talking about the weather and speaking about everyday life to us is important. So I get it's just a different communication style. But the way we communicate is always kind of pathologized and always made to feel wrong. And I think my argument is that it's not wrong, it's just different. And again, if I could have explained I'm autistic, and I still think people would have looked down on me. I still think people would have adopted the attitude that I've had since diagnosis, where all of a sudden they start condescending you because all of a sudden, oh, you're autistic, even though I've been speaking to you like a normal human being up until this point. You're autistic now, so I'm going to patronize you because clearly you're not my equal. And you're like, oh my gosh, it's just so annoying because I am your equal. Really, the reason I've shared this with you is so that you understand I'm just kind of operating differently, but that is sadly not how a lot of people view you. Or you get the other people, oh, you're autistic. Oh my gosh, you're a genius. Oh, you're better than the rest of us. I don't think that either. You know, across the board, doesn't matter about your neurotype. You've got amazing brains out there and you've got average brains, and it doesn't matter. You need all of us. So, but yeah, I definitely wish I'd known. I think it would have really helped in so many situations. You know, I could have explained, oh, I'm struggling today. I'm really sorry if you feel I'm being standoffish, but I'm struggling today with the environment. I'm struggling with these lights. I'm struggling with the noise in the classroom. I just think those things would have been helpful. So again, I'm not saying you as an autistic person don't still go through all of this nonsense, and people still aren't always going to be empathetic and kind and understand you. But again, I think it gives you more of a fighting chance, especially in today's society where we do have to kind of make reasonable adjustments in schools and workplaces. And I just wish I'd known so I could have advocated for things. Even when I was working and I developed that issue when I was in the bank, I had problems with my workspace and no one else was complaining. And you feel always like, oh, you know, why me? I now realise, like I said, I've got hypermobility. So it was probably related to that and why I was more sensitive to how the chair was and, you know, how that kind of developed injuries for me. And I overworked. Again, controlling how I was perceived, controlling my environment. I overworked and then I got accused of trying to make my colleagues look bad. But the truth was, I overworked for me. I used to set targets for myself. So we had a target we had to meet, but I used to meet that target effortlessly. So I would then set myself targets. So say, for example, I was processing something. I would, I think 750 was the actual target. And then I would be like, right, let's do 800, 850, up to 1,000. And then when I started going past 1,000, I'd be like, right, okay, how high can I go? And I think my average wound up being around 1,400, 1,450, but it was always over 1,000. And I used to get told off all the time in the end because they said, you're making everyone look bad. And you're just trying to show up your colleagues. And literally, it was never to do with that. It was more about me and setting my... And also, it wasn't just about wanting to appear perfect, actually. It was also because that job was mundane and I had to give myself little challenges to keep myself going in it because it was boring. And, you know, how do you explain that to people? And then I had to actually physically, to have people not despise me, then decrease the statistics. I had to decrease my output. And I think this is another thing people don't realise, you know, that I've sometimes been self-deprecating on purpose or I've belittled myself. And that's another pattern I got into. And I think, for example, when I was at school, I was quite academic and I was quite able and people always saw me as very intelligent. And there were times where I would make mistakes on purpose so that I was more accessible to people. And that sounds absolutely dreadful, doesn't it? But there were some people who thought I was really stuck up. And so what I started to do is kind of put myself down and dumb myself down to be liked and to be accepted. And I thought that was unique to me, but I've spoken to so many other neurodivergent people who've had the same experience and said they did the same things. I think people underestimate the fact that even without a diagnosis, we know we're different. And we are desperate to fit in. We see everybody else just going about life and it seems so easy for them, and we don't understand why it's not for us. So again, having that diagnosis and that label is something that when our children, when our eldest was very young, we were dead against, because we didn't want people thinking things of him. We didn't want people having misconceptions about him. We wanted them to accept him for who he was and, you know, not think, oh, he's autistic. So, and then put whatever their opinions of autism were on him. But then we got to a point where we reflected on our experiences and how much easier things would have been. And also the fact that, you know, we needed the support for him, and without actually having the label, sadly, it's really hard to get that support. And it would be great if it was needs-based and it was individually based, individual-based, rather than needing a diagnosis. But sadly, that is not the way the world works. And so then we became a lot more kind of pro-diagnosis and have realised ourselves how much it would have helped us. And we appreciate there are many barriers, including cost, the fact that a lot of professionals are very out of date, that, you know, certain genders, for example, I'm very conscious of saying women and girls, because although, you know, women and girls on the spectrum are not understood at the same level, because it's still very much based on little boys and out of date criteria, I do appreciate it's not binary. You know, I've had gentlemen contact me saying, you know, well, actually, I present like this. So it's not just women and girls who present like this. And, you know, so I know that it's not quite as binary, but at the moment, that's how things are described. But there are many barriers to diagnosis, and that is why I think self-identification needs to be valid. But then there are so many people saying it's overdiagnosed. Anybody can apply that to themselves. As I've said before, why on earth you would want to apply this to yourself if it really truly doesn't fit your experience is beyond me. What do we gain from it? Someone on my blog once said, oh, is it because you want to be diagnosed with autism so that you can get loads of support and money? Believe me, at least where I live, there is nothing for you. But what it does do is it gives you validation. It enables you to accept everything that you've been through and why you were different. And at the moment, again, I'm going through another kind of loop of struggling and grieving with all these experiences. You know, I've had experiences with workplaces, like colleagues, other students when I was studying, family, friends. And I am quite, you know, over the years, I've become more isolated and private, for my own preservation, my self-preservation, because the more I'm around people, the more misunderstood I am. And because I am a little bit inconsistent, because I don't know how I'm going to feel from one day to the next, I don't know what I'm going to be able to access. I don't really enjoy going out. And then sometimes I'll say, oh yeah, okay, I'll come along. And I might feel like at the time, yeah, I can do this. By the time the situation comes around, I can't attend. And then you let people down and you're unreliable. And it's safer for me to then just shut myself away from the world. But people see that as you rejecting them, and they don't understand what's driving it internally. And that actually, for a lot of us, we've had so many years of these failed interactions and trauma that it's easier for us to just push everyone away, really. And it's really difficult because you have the yearning for those relationships and you have the yearning for this acceptance. But we've had a whole lifetime of feeling rejected and different and wrong and not accepted. And, you know, told everything we're doing is incorrect, even when we've tried our best. So, you know, you can understand from my psychology why we are then online seeking out people like us who are going to understand where we are coming from. And I don't like that I feel like this. I mean, I'm even reliving things at the moment that I've been through with family members and people that are not even in my life anymore. Or in some cases, people that now know I'm autistic and have tried to make amends, or some people who haven't. And I'm looping on a lot of things, and it's still bringing up a lot of emotion for me. So it's not something that, you know, you find out you're autistic and suddenly everything is gone, everything is healed, everything is forgotten. It isn't. It's really quite distressing to think that I was diagnosed at 37 years old, and although I knew years before, no one took that seriously because I wasn't formally diagnosed. And that's why self-identification has to be valid. If someone comes to you and says, I believe I'm autistic, and explains ABC, don't dismiss them. because it would have taken them an awful lot of research and an awful lot to come to you to tell you that. And then people would go, well, where's your piece of paper? I don't believe you. And it's really horrid because you suddenly kind of have the answers and you want people to go away and do their research and you want people to go away and reflect on the interactions they've had with you. But I think that's what I was expecting when I was diagnosed, is people to be humble, I suppose, and be like, oh my word, some of the things I've accused you of, and no, it's because you're autistic. You're not being standoffish and stuck up. You're autistic. Oh, you weren't rejecting us when you didn't want to come to, you know, the really loud coffee shop with the bright lights. It was just that that wasn't a nice setting for you to be in. But we were never going to adapt that for you without knowing you were autistic. Because why can't you just put yourself in that situation? I think this is the problem. You go through all of these experiences and people don't see you. And they don't see that actually, even if you don't have that label, that you might be uncomfortable with something. You're not allowed to be. But when you have your label, it's like a little bit more accepted sometimes. I want to go back to the university experience because there is something actually quite prominent that I loop on from there. And again, not knowing I was autistic, so I keep saying this just to kind of hammer it home. I had this disability, but I didn't perceive it as a disability. And again, being autistic, there are things that I didn't think about or think to research. They were not on my radar. And although I had this problem in my arm, it didn't really occur to me that I was disabled. I was disabled because I couldn't do things with this arm. I couldn't write properly and type. Everything was very difficult. I obviously had a lot of other needs. For example, the environment itself was very, very difficult for me, but I couldn't understand why because I didn't know why. And no one would have taken me seriously. When I was agitated by bright lights, I didn't know why I was agitated by bright lights. And nobody else really was empathetic towards the fact that I struggled with certain things, or going to the cinema because I felt very claustrophobic and I couldn't stand the noise coming from the speakers. So again, you try and avoid these things, or you go to them and then you're feeling really agitated and then they sense that from you, but they don't know why. They think it's about them. You can't explain why. You're just feeling agitated. So I never really knew kind of the level of disability I had, if that makes sense. And people scoff at that, that I would ever refer to myself or my children as disabled. But actually, in some settings and situations, I am. And I think now again, we know who I am and why. It's really evident. And I've been able to identify a lot of that. So now we can make accommodations and change things. And I feel much more confident saying, no, I can't do this, or I don't want to do this because ABC. But again, without knowing this, people just don't accept it. They just think you're being awkward. And we still actually get that from people now. They still haven't actually. You know, we thought, oh, I get the magical diagnosis and people will suddenly understand and suddenly adapt for you. But they don't. That is the reality, sadly. You know, those that really care about you do try. But it kind of really does unpick who's there for you and who really loves and understands you and who doesn't. And then some people sadly are incapable. But anyway, back to the point. So university was a hard experience, but I didn't realise how hard it was. I didn't realise why I was struggling so much. And with commuting and that kind of thing on the train, I mean, that was horrendous. So sometimes I could not get myself in just simply because I had this avoidance. I had this resistance to doing these things. But I tried where possible to push myself to really try and complete this degree because I wanted to be a teacher so badly. And it's the only thing that kept me going was, right, if you want to be a teacher, you need to get this bit out of the way. But I hated the entire experience, if I'm honest with you. But I kind of like muddled through my degree. My first 2 years were awful. Then I had my operation. And the third year, I felt like, yeah, I can attack this. And I did. And my grades all raised. And I was able to do more because I could write and I could actually be a bit more comfortable. But then we had a week of exams and it was the final week of the final year. I think it was 2 weeks of 3-hour exams, so lots of writing. And all of a sudden, my arm flared up at the end of week two. So it was, I'd done all of my exams and one was outstanding. And I went to the lecturers and said, look, my arm, it's swollen. I couldn't hold a pen. And I said to them, I physically cannot sit the exam on Friday. I am in so much pain. What am I going to do? And they were actually fine. They said, look, you know, we can always delay this exam, if you like, for you, but we do need a doctor's note. But we can see that you are really struggling. But how about, you know, we get you to retake this in the summer? Now, for me, that was hell on earth. The anxiety of having to wait like weeks or months to complete this degree. I just wanted it over and done with. I needed it out of my cognitive load, if that makes sense. And I was like, oh, gosh, I really wish I could just sit it on Friday. And they said, normally we could actually allocate a scribe for you, but it's too last minute, so we can't arrange anything that quickly. But they said, look, first thing you need to do is you need to see our nurse. So the next morning, or it might have been that morning, I can't remember, I had to get a train to my university and go and see the nurse. And she was horrific to me. It was the first time, so bear in mind, this is my fourth year now, if you include my year out. It was the first time somebody actually used the term disabled. Nobody had really ever said, oh, you're struggling. They all knew about my arm and my operation, but nobody had ever said it. And I think they were angry at me for not having kind of identified it myself. But this is where, again, people look at you and think, well, you're quite intelligent. You know, you're at university. We see you are an articulate individual. Why have you not come to us with this before? It just wasn't something I thought about. And I'm quite naive. There are things that I just, if I don't know about it, I don't know about it. I would not have made that connection. I sometimes have this kind of inability to make connections, just like my children. And people don't give you that. They just look at you and see you superficially at face value that you are functioning absolutely fine. And they expect you to be like everybody else. And again, that's where the label kind of would have helped, I think. I don't think I'd have been treated quite as deplorably had we known, or at least that's the hope. Anyway, this nurse, I thought, you know, I'll go speak to her, show her my arm and explain my history. And she went, for goodness sake, why on earth have you not flagged yourself up as a disabled student before now? How could you wait this long? And I said, oh, I didn't even really think of it. You didn't think that having a bad arm meant that you had a disability and you've had an operation on your arm? I said, no, it didn't really occur to me. And she then just started kind of being really horrible and firing all this stuff at me. And I tuned out, actually. I just remember looking at her and it was her tone of voice was just so aggressive. And she was so condescending and so cross with me. And I just don't remember actually hearing any words. I just remember this horrible feeling of, oh, I've had this all my life of people just never understanding me and people reprimanding me for things and me not really understanding why. And I just looked at her and I said to her, look, I just literally need you to please help me with this exam. They said they might be able to provide a scribe. She said, look, we can get a scribe sorted for you, but it won't be until Monday. Now, that made me happy because Monday, you know, was, I think by the exam was Friday. So by the Monday, that would have only been a rest over the weekend. And then they can get someone to write it for me on the Monday, meaning I didn't have to wait weeks or months to retake the exam. I didn't need more revision time. It wasn't a ploy. It was literally that I could not physically hold my pen. I was in so much pain. And I also have very sensitive fingertips anyway. So that's another issue. Like I struggle with a lot of writing anyway because of and typing. Like if I am on the computer too much, I struggle because that's one of the issues I have for my sensory processing. But again, didn't know that at the time, so couldn't really discuss that. Anyway, this lady, she was really, really horrid. And then she said, right, you know, we can do this, this, this for you, but you have to go to the doctor this afternoon and get a doctor's note to get yourself out of tomorrow's exam and for us to be able to arrange the scribe. So I called the doctor and got an emergency appointment. They were not very nice to me on the phone, but I said to them, I'm sorry, but this isn't, you know, I've been told I need it by tomorrow. And then I think I actually had to go on the train back up there again the next day to take it physically in person. So, you know, this was not something you would do lightly, is it, if you were just trying to get out of taking the exam? And the reason I'm telling you this is because of what happened next. So I went to the doctor that very afternoon and she was awful. I mean, I'd had some bad experiences with this woman anyway. She was a horrible, horrible doctor. Just really, really cold. I remember going to her once and I avoided going to the doctor because of how I got treated at the doctor's. And I remember going and I had two or three things wrong. And I said, look, I shouldn't have left it this long, but I hate coming here. And this is what I've got wrong. And she said, do you know what? I am sick of it. I'm sick of you coming in with a few things. Do you know what? I'm not going to look at all these things. You choose one and then you make another appointment. And I was just really shell-shocked. And she was like, in future, don't build them up. again, no understanding as to like why I was avoiding going, and that attitude that she had for me. And sadly, she was my GP, and at that point, you couldn't ask for another, and it was just awful. I hated her. I really hated her. And so I used to go through a lot of pain. For example, when I was at the bank and I had this problem in my arm, they actually prescribed me this patch, like a lidocaine or lidocaine patch, and they were really expensive, but I didn't know this. Now, at the time, I was working for a bank, and they sent me to a private doctor, and they prescribed this. Now, again, I'm very naive. I had to jump through hoops. The bank were like, you know, for us to say, yes, you have this condition, and for us to support you at work, you have to go to one of our doctors. So I just did that. And then my GP refused to actually issue me this this patch, because she said, if you can go to a private doctor, then you should be paying for it yourself. And I was like, I had to go to that doctor to kind of jump through the hoops for my workplace, but I can't afford to pay for them myself. And then she said, well, you're not having them then. As it happened, my pharmacist then actually contacted the surgery and said, this lady is in agony and really needs this support. And then they ended up getting issued. But this woman, I feel like she just hated me and had this vendetta. And I think it's because, again, it is literally because I'm different and because I didn't communicate the way, like, I think I told you on the last podcast that I said things like, I'd go in and how are you today? Fine. And of course, you know, that didn't go down well. But I think, I don't know if I'm giving really very adequate examples, but it's just these little minor things through my life that have kind of created difficulties with communication, and then people not being very nice to me. I feel like I have been constantly bullied, to be honest with you, and never really understanding why. And it's obviously how I come across, but I'm not doing anything purposely. I think that I'm kind and polite, and I think that, you know, I'm very upfront. But yeah, it is sadly it's caused a lot of problems for me because of how I communicate. And I don't think that there is anything wrong with me, but I think that people expect different things from you. And again, when you're so-called high functioning, they don't understand underneath the surface what is really going on. You know, I've put this superficial mask on. I'm mimicking everyone around me, but I'm not truly like them. I don't truly understand what I'm saying or doing. So that's another PDA thing, isn't it? The superficial sociability. You use masking and you use kind of what you see around you, but you don't really understand it. It doesn't go deep. And so therefore there's this conflict, and people see this. I was accused once of like not being a genuine person or and this kind of thing. And I've had many of those things over the years, and I am so genuine. But I suppose what they're sensing is the fact they're not really getting the real me, but they're not getting the real me. But then I can't show the real me. And again, this is the difficulty, I think, in being autistic. I am trying so hard to unmask now as a lady in my late 30s. But that's still not an easy process. I still enter performer mode when I'm out in the world. You know, it's learnt behaviour and I can't physically help it. But yeah, just let's finish that story about the GP. So in the end, I got in with her and it was just horrible. I mean, who would put themselves through this, seriously, if they didn't need to? And I explained the situation and she examined my arm. And although she did admit that obviously it was swollen, she actually got angry with me. And she said, I tell you what, I cannot stand students like you. I feel sorry for your university. And I was just shocked. I don't know why at this point, because this is what she was like, absolutely toxic. And I just looked at her and I cried. And she said something about me turning on the waterworks, I think. And then she said, look, I will write you this letter, but you are paying for it because I am not happy with you. She said, you obviously just want more revision time. I was like, no, actually, that's not true at all. I said, if I could just get this completed this week, it would be amazing. But I can't. I can't physically write and they can't provide a scribe for me until Monday. What am I supposed to do? And she just tutted, shook her head and said, the letter will be ready at this time. Come back and get it. And it will cost this much. And then I walked out and I just cried and cried and cried. And, you know, I did wind up being able to take it up to the university. And then on the Monday, I did take my exam and I had a scribe who was just lovely. And then I was so grateful that that was like the end of that stage of my life. But I was treated really poorly by some of the staff up there, and I was treated really poorly by the nurse and then the doctor, and it all came to a head. And when the scribe actually said, "Oh, I'll give you a lift to the train station, save you walking," which was so sweet, I actually cried when I got to the station. I'd gone into mask mode, you see, that day. Oh, I'm fine. But it all just got too much, and I cried, and she was lovely. And then I came home and I just broke down. And I then went on a bit of a loop. I went on a bit of a meltdown, I suppose, for a little while after, about, you know, just reliving all these horrible experiences and conversations and people not being very empathetic and kind. And then I think I ended up emailing the nurse and all the faculty with a breakdown of everything that had been said and done and how they'd made me feel. And not one responded. And what's really interesting is I've reflected now as an adult who knows I'm autistic and knows more about law. I think the reason they didn't is because actually it was clear, even though we didn't know I was autistic, that I was a disabled student. And I think they know that actually how I was treated, because there's so much more that I haven't obviously shared with you, but how I was treated and the lack of support there was for me was shocking, to be honest with you. And like I said, I think what it is it does sound very woe is me and like I'm the victim, and I'm not trying to come across like that. But life has actually been really, really tough, and I'm still trying to make sense of a lot of things. And there are some things I'm never going to get closure on, and that's really, really hard. And I can talk about that another time, but I have said before about even in workplaces, you know, I told you about the bank telling me that I overworked. It happened when I was teaching too. And then I've also told you about how I'm so conscientious that I actually found out there'd been some fraudulent activity at one of the schools I worked in, and I exposed it because, again, I'm so ethical. You know, and it's interesting because I am so rule driven. But people don't see that as a positive thing, whereas I do. I think that, you know, depending, there are some rules that are made to be bent, obviously. but when it comes to children and grading them and setting targets for them and setting them up to fail, I'm sorry, I'm just not down with that. So I did take that further. And that wound up being the beginning of the end of my career. And that is for another discussion that I've already shared before. But I think what I just wanted to get across to everybody is that, you know, being late diagnosed does come with its trauma. There are many reasons as to why we forever loop on the experiences that came before us, especially those where we don't get the understanding and support that we need and the closure that we need to move on. But even if I did get all of those things, the actual truth is I think it would help on some level for the person inside and for that younger version of me to feel like, okay, they can see I'm not a bad person, or, you know, now people understand why I was different, and hopefully that will kind of make them see me in a new light, even though it hasn't happened, sadly, in a lot of cases. But even with that closure, I still don't think that I'll ever be able to truly move on, because you have still had all of those experiences and they have still had such a negative impact to the point that I will never set foot in a workplace. I do not trust anyone. I considered returning to study, and then all of the trauma of this came back up and I was like, nope. So there are things that I now will not do in my life, and people will say, you know, suck it up and get over it. But I've spent my whole life masking and sucking it up and trying to get over it and pretending I'm okay and I'm done with it. And I think that's what diagnosis has given me, is that ability to go, no, you know, I'm not comfortable with this. I don't want to put myself in that situation again. I already know how I'm going to be viewed and treated. And okay, it might be different now that we know who I am, because I can advocate for myself better. But sadly, because of all the trauma that's been done, I still struggle. And for example, why it's so appropriate, why it's so relevant is the medical side of things. I still struggle with doctor's appointments. I am 38 years old and I still struggle to call them. I struggle to speak to them. I struggle to communicate my needs. I would still prefer to take my mum with me if that was an option. I would still prefer somebody else to make my appointment and talk on my behalf. I still prefer to send an email. I still prefer to write everything down. I still feel very dismissed. I still feel that they think everything I say is, you know, just not valid. And I still get made to feel that me being autistic is also not valid. And the trauma that happens to you shapes who you become. And there are some things I think, you know, I wouldn't be me without that. I wouldn't be able to help other people in certain areas without having experienced it myself. I wouldn't be able to advocate for my children to the way I do if maybe I hadn't lived it and understand it intrinsically, internally. Can't think what the word is at the moment. You know, so there are so many things where I'm like, you know, you can't regret this. You can't regret this because it's got you where you are now. But on the other hand, I've seen so many things online where they go, you know, they celebrate trauma, you know, as this kind of rite of passage or making you strong and resilient. And actually, I was called strong and resilient for years and I saw it as this massive compliment. But now I see it as, no, that was just me masking because I don't feel strong and I don't feel resilient. I've had to be. I didn't want to be. It was not a choice. It is not something I would choose for myself or any other individual. And actually, it has made me not trust people and it has made me doubt myself over the years and it has made me not like the world. So I don't see that as a positive. Anyway, I'm going to end it there. Thank you so much for listening and speak soon.